Welcome to Fate's Wide Wheel, a Quantum Leap podcast with Sam and Dennis. We are coming to you from our top secret headquarters at Project Quantum Leap, but you can find us online at fwwquantumleappod.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And please do us a favor by hitting the subscribe button on iTunes. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Fate's Wide Wheel. We're here today at Project Quantum Leap, Sam and Dennis, and joined by our guest, Annie.
Hello.
Hello, Annie. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show, you guys. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for joining us.
And then also, full disclosure, also, as if to say hello, also in the room, we have my son, Harrison, as long with Mama and my wife, Betsy. They are also hanging out in the room with us today. So he may chime in on occasion here.
But, you know, we're a family-friendly podcast, except for when we drop the F-bomb.
Except when we curse, yeah. So here we go. So welcome. Last episode of the first season.
That's right. We made our way.
Yeah, and we should also address, for those who listened to last week's episode, was Kamikaze Kid, and we had some creepiness sneak into the episode. That was actually the first episode of the podcast that Annie had listened to before, right?
Yes, and I made an appearance little to my knowledge.
That's right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we had some fun with that one, mm-hmm. as you can tell. We both worked on that one. Generally, I usually do the editing of the episodes. Dennis kind of handles all of our social media and that sort of stuff, so I end up kind of handling the editing in. But this one was definitely a collaborative effort, to say the least. In fact, mm-hmm. I think Dennis ended up really doing most of the heavy lifting on that
I
one.
I jumped in, yeah. I had a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, and we did. We just had a lot of fun with it. We figured, since we decided not to do the B-Man as an episode for Halloween and keep up with our chronological order, that we should at least acknowledge that strange things happen.
A little hat tip to Halloween to the Halloween episode.
So we had a good time with that one. Nothing too obtrusive, so I think you were able to still get what you wanted from mm-hmm. the Kamikaze Kid.
Yes, yeah.
But now we find ourselves here at the end of the first season for Play It Again, Seymour. This is written by Scott Shepard, directed by Aaron Lipstadt. Aired May 17th, 1989. Our leap date is April 14th, 1953, which we'll talk about a little bit. And we're in Brooklyn, New York. Sam has leaped into Nick Allen. And our TV guide synopsis is, it looks like the beginning of a beautiful friendship when Sam, Scott Bakula, as a bogey-like Seamus, teams with a neat kid to find the hitman who killed his partner. And that's really all you need to know.
That's a pretty straightforward TV guide review. We've had some.
Yeah.
The one for Kamikaze Kid was pretty...
I couldn't even make it through it without laughing.
Yes. So that was a pretty straightforward one. So we should also note, Annie, how many episodes of Quantum Leap have you seen?
One.
Which one?
I've seen Play It Again, Seymour.
That's
the only one.
And you were not even like really aware of the concept of the series before.
Well, I kind of knew like a little bit. Like, because I listened to the episode first that you guys recorded, mm-hmm. and then I watched Play It Again, Seymour. So I kind of, listening to you guys talk about it, I got, like, the basic concepts of it. But there were some parts, you know, and it's a credit to the storytelling, I think, of the writer, that I was able to catch on pretty quickly what exactly the confines of the world were. And, although it was a little bit confusing who Al was. For like the first 10 minutes of the episode, I was like, wait, so is this guy part of the world? Or is he from the future? Or who is he? And it wasn't until he took out his little computer, like, handheld thing. Mm-hmm. Like the
hand-like.
It is. I was like, oh, okay, so he's part of, like, the jumping back and forth. But, I caught on pretty quickly. And, I don't think I'd miss too much not knowing much about the show. So.
Yeah.
But we'll see. Once you guys start talking about it, I'm sure I'll be like, oh, what? It's
like, oh, no, you know, I think that for the first season in particular, and even most of the series as a whole, you don't need to know everything about it. It's definitely not serialized. It's not something where, you know, you come in halfway through a season and you're completely lost. You could absolutely just catch a few episodes here or there. Play It Again, Seymour is interesting because I mean, once you kind of figure out where Al is coming from, the rest of the episode plays out pretty much just, you don't need to know anything, really. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't need to know any background on Sam. You don't need to know anything. You just know that here this guy is in 1953 now, and he's traveling through time, and that's that.
Yeah. We've talked a lot about this in previous episodes, is that the first season leaned a lot heavier into genre episodes, and this is very clearly a genre episode that fully embraces the old film noir.
Yeah, and I...
How do you feel about that, Sam?
Well, so I love film noir. I do. I think the struggle that this episode has is that it doesn't plant its feet in one direction or another when it comes to being serious or being parody. And I think it suffers because of that.
I can see that.
I think that, you know, we get this opening shot, which is like heavy and atmospheric, of Sam standing there with, you know, literally with the smoking gun over his who we find out is his partner, dead, riddled with bullet holes. Cops come in and get ready to, you know, arrest Sam. So I don't know. I think as a whole, it's a fun episode, and it's I guess it's a fun episode of Quantum Leap. But when I rewatched it, if I were to have to take it or leave it, I'd probably leave this one. Actually,
interesting.
This is the one you had me watch.
I didn't
watch a first time Quantum Leaper, and you give me the one that you would leave.
Well,
you
had a foggy memory.
Like there were two of them because we were recording this episode and Honeymoon Express, which is the next episode on. The same day, and it's a very flimsy connection, but between you and having our guest host next week, which is my wife Betsy, the very flimsy connection is one of the first shows that we worked on together, because Annie, as an actor as well, was a film noir inspired show.
It's true, yes. That is a flimsy connection.
That is a very flimsy connection. But you were basically the Allison in that.
I know, and she was great. I love her.
Claudia Christian is awesome. And honestly, I think for me, that's one of the reasons why I had such fond memories of the episode, because I really like her, and she was in one of my other favorite TV shows, Babylon 5.
She's in Freaks and Geeks too.
She was in Freaks and Geeks.
I had
that's
to
right.
look her up on IMDb because I couldn't figure out how I recognized her. I was like, she was Bill's mom on Freaks and Geeks.
She's great. I really like her a lot, and I think that that certainly was one of the reasons why I probably liked the episode so much. I remember this is actually one of the episodes that I can literally remember watching when it aired, it would have been about a week or so before my 8th birthday.
It would have been May 17th, 1989.
Yeah, so it was 10 days before my 8th birthday. And I can remember watching this episode because I remember the elevator scene pretty vividly. We had two TVs in the house that we lived in Independence, Missouri, which is when this aired. And one was in the front room and one was in this den area. And I watched most episodes of Quantum Leap in the den, because that was the area where I could go where nobody else would bother me and I wouldn't bother them with Quantum Leap. But I remember watching this episode in the front room, and I don't remember why exactly, but I do remember being alone. I think my mom was in the kitchen doing something or whatever, but I remember watching it by myself. So I guess for that reason, it probably has a special place in my heart. But for some reason, I don't know, when I watched it last night, I was just kind of a little,
hello,
you know,
man.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump into it.
Let's do it.
So first off, we have, if you're watching like the original air, the Blu-ray, we get the intro. This one, it's a little bit less, explainy. They've dropped the... It all started when a time travel experiment I was conducting, blah, blah, blah.
A little caca.
Yeah, this one was like, some days I have good days, I win the race, stop the bad guy and kiss the girl, showing clips from last week's episode.
Kamikaze Kid.
Then there are bad days when he is standing over a dead body. Like you mentioned, the cops break in. Unless he has a good reason why he's standing over a dead body, he's going to miss the Dodgers opener. And Sam makes the observation that he's still in L.A. because that's where last week's episode took place.
Right.
And I can't remember what the cop says, but basically makes some smart ass comment to correct him. They're in Brooklyn because this is before.
Well, the funny thing is he doesn't say Brooklyn though. He just basically makes a smart ass comment about Sam not knowing what he's talking about, or pretend, or like, oh, you're gonna cop insanity on us or something like
that. Oh yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah. And And for our baseball fans playing along at home, the Dodgers were in Brooklyn until 1957. Mm. And at this point, Sam looks over and sees a newspaper, which talks about the home opener.
No, he doesn't see the newspaper. They do a really interesting thing that I don't remember from any other episode. They escort him out.
Uh-huh.
And the office is empty, and the camera just pans over.
Okay.
To the news, to the newspaper, and it comes in on the date of April 14th, 1953, which you kind of alluded as to why that is a unique date.
Right. It's before Sam was born.
It is.
Yeah.
So, Annie, Quantum Leap newbie.
Yes.
Sam was born on August 8th, 1953, which they established pretty early on. But they also established Sam is only supposed to be able to time travel within his own lifetime.
So, why does he get to go back further?
But if you want to stretch it, by this point he would have been conceived.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So he is.
So you can't say like I've read some things, and I think Matt Dell even references in his trivia book, like from this you could take that Don Belisario, that the show has taken a very pro life stance, that life begins from conception,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Or you can just kind of take it that writers didn't have a firm grasp on what they were doing in the first few episodes, and
right.
How many writers are there? Are there like a lot of writers, or just a handful, or is there a different writer per episode?
No, not for every episode this season, but for most of them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that mm-hmm. Belisario wrote, like, what, two or three, and mm-hmm. Pratt wrote two.
Mm-hmm. And Deborah Pratt was co-executive producer, and also the series creator's wife.
Oh, okay.
So she wrote a handful of episodes. And then, otherwise, I think they, this was a show where, like, they shopped it out where you could submit scripts.
And it was, because this was before there were really, I mean, some shows had this, sure, but you didn't really have, like, today where you have the writer's room where, you know, you've got, like, seven people who are the only people that write these shows, and they're collaborating most of the time, so they just throw somebody's name on the episode because they've got to throw somebody's name on the episode, but in truth, they all wrote it, you know,
right,
it's
right.
Not, like, mm-hmm. not like Game of Thrones or something, but yeah, this, so, yeah, this one, this is, Scott Shepherd, who's credited as the writer for the teleplay. It's his first. He'd not written.
He co-wrote the story for Kamikaze Kid.
Okay.
He wrote Blind Faith, which is another episode coming up. He also co-wrote. I won't run through them all. He co-wrote another upcoming episode for season two.
But this is his first actual writing credit on the mm-hmm. teleplay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting though, because this one also it's noted that the story, however, was by Tom Blomquist and Scott Shepherd and Donald P. Belisario.
Mm.
And if I'm not mistaken, the way that I'm reading this is that Tom Blomquist and Scott Shepherd actually came up with the story, but Don Belisario gets the credit because he's the creator of the show.
Mm.
I don't think it has anything to do with him actually crafting any of this particular story or the teleplay.
Mm.
We'll jump back in here.
But here we are. So
the Dodgers mix-up is fun. You know, I like that. I think it's interesting because, you know, Sam, in spite of his Swiss cheese memory, he does remember these certain little things now and then. Mm-hmm. But then he gets hauled off to jail.
Mm-hmm. So here we are. We are in jail. And pretty early on, he looks in the mirror and he sees that the person he has leaped into bears a very strong resemblance to Humphrey Bogart.
Of course he does.
Doesn't. I'm like, okay, it looks nothing like Humphrey Bogart.
close enough.
If you squint. If you squint, you know.
Yeah, I guess.
On a 1989 TV set, I mean, come on.
I had very poor eyesight in the 50s. They're all like, Mr. Bogart. It's like, okay.
Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm.
Guess he's dressed like Humphrey Bogart.
Mm.
There is that.
Close enough. But even from like I said, this very first scene, like, Sam always provides voiceover narration in every episode. But this one, just from the beginning, you can tell that they're leaning heavily into the film noir.
Which is something we actually mentioned before, I think, in an episode when we were talking about the genres and playing with the tropes and about how this one feels appropriate because mm-hmm. of that fact. You know,
mm-hmm.
the voiceover, it's a note that I took as well, that the voiceover works very well in this genre. And obviously, and Sam really kind of plays it to the hilt. You know, the writers are clearly having fun with it.
You could tell that they were, like, having a blast thinking of the cheesiest phrases they could possibly drum up from, like, this gumshoe genre.
And then Al appears. I think his first line is played against Sam. And for all the times that he corrects Sam throughout this episode for misquoting, he's actually making a pretty common misquote of Casablanca as well. Because I think he's simply play it.
Yeah, he says, play it, Sam. Play it again and again and again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is interesting because, you know, I mean, it's obvious, of course, if you've got this, you know, bogey lookalike or whatever, you're going to steer into Casablanca. But Casablanca is not the most film noir of Bogey's movies by a long shot. You know, in fact, there are some that would argue that it's, you know, it's film noir only because it's in black and white, but that the story itself is not really, you know, a part of that genre or whatever. I mean, I love the film. It's one of my favorite movies ever. So, I mean,
I actually saw it for the first time ever like 2 weeks ago.
Seriously?
Yeah. No way. It was actually a nice coincidence that I watched that episode. I understand these.
I'm going to throw this out. I don't think I've ever seen it all the way through.
No.
Really?
I don't. I think. Oh, and my wife Betsy just shot a look across the room. She's divorcing me now.
Papers are being drawn up as we speak.
Check it out, seriously. It holds up.
Well, I mean, it
does, but like when I was watching it, I'm like, oh man, there's so many parodiable moments in this movie. But then I realized that, you know, this was the start of, like, this is the basis of all those parodies. And it's at the time, you wouldn't watch that and be like, oh my God, you got to be kidding me.
Right.
So, but now it's like you watch it and you have all this reference of, like, you know, The Simpsons making fun of Casablanca and, or not making fun, but parodying it. And it was just interesting. That's all.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It is interesting when you go back and you watch some older films like that, and you see those things that, you know, by today's standards, it's been done so many times, or it's been poked fun at, or it's been, you know.
It's now considered derivative, but...
But right, at the time, it was, you know, breaking new ground. So he misquotes it, and Al does not, you know, correct him. Which is funny, though, because he, you know, throughout the episode, he never corrects him on the quote. It's that he corrects him on who said the quote.
Yes.
Which is also very funny, because Sam starts getting into, like, you know, in this very moment, like, he's like, you dirty rat, you know, and it's like, that's Cagney.
Yeah, and even that is a misquote.
Yeah.
In and of itself. So, they're all over the place.
Right, right.
But at first, Sam mistakenly thinks that he might be Humphrey Bogart, but Al clarifies that, no, he is...
Nick
somewhere,
Allen.
That Bogart is filming Sabrina in Long Island with Lauren Bacall, is that
William Holden and Audrey Hepburn.
Oh, Audrey Hepburn, there you go.
Who were having a mad affair on the set. And Bogey was a little protective of Audrey and wasn't quite sure if that was what she should be doing, but he also thought, you know, you're an adult, so you do what you gotta do. I know things. That's like our favorite dwarf. I drink and I know things.
There you go. And so Al just basically shows up to just kind of give him the basics of the situation. But if he doesn't need him, he's got to take off because Tina's got a friend. Then we have this moment where, like, Al, don't tell me you're cheating on Tina. He's like, Tina's got a friend who has this, who has a lead on a horse race, so that's where I'm going.
He's gonna bet on the horse race, and you know, and Al even says something about, like, do you think so little of me that, you know, that you're gonna jump to conclusions? And Sam's just like, yes. and then the cops do show up.
Sam has this moment of deja vu before they show up. He looks like he's like, oh hey, I know what's about to happen. A bald guy with a cigar is about to come in and say my bullet doesn't match the gun. I will say, before they come in, there's a nice little moment with a background character, like a drunk passed out.
Singing. There's nothing much to add to that, but he's just sitting up there singing a song, and you know, in the background. And,
but he's also, like, not playing drunk very well.
Tell us your thoughts on that, Annie.
I don't know. Whatever. It was just like, that guy is an actor playing drunk. He's not actually... being drunk, I guess, you know.
Yeah,
was my take on it.
That is not only a comment worth making in any situation, but in this episode in particular, I think that it is particularly salient, because I find that through a lot of this episode, and this might be one of my problems with the episode in 2017 as opposed to 7-year-old Sam, is that it feels like a lot of the actors are playing at the genre and the trope, as opposed to just being in it.
Right.
And I think that that contrasts heavily with some of the other things like Kamikaze Kid or Color of Truth or even Honeymoon Express. Those episodes are clearly playing with some tropes here and there, but you don't get the feeling that the actor's like playing at it. You know, they're doing it. But then, of course, as he has this premonition, this sense of deja vu, exactly what he said was going to happen happens. Mm-hmm. And I do feel like it's worth noting, because occasionally we like to talk about this stuff, that Lieutenant Lannan, the bald, cigar-chomping mm-hmm. police officer, is played by Richard Reel, who's another one of those actors that was just all over the place. And I mm-hmm. recognized him right away, but I couldn't mm-hmm. exactly place where. Mm-hmm. And I realized the reason why is because he's just been in everything. I mean, mm-hmm. this is the type of guy that was doing like 20 things a year mm-hmm. every year, even today. Like, mm-hmm. the guy's still like all over the place. Turns out, though, however, that not only is he in this episode, but he pops up in another episode of Quantum Leap down the road. He was in Star Trek The Next Generation and arguably one of the finest episodes of Star Trek ever, The Inner Light.
Yes.
He pops up in Star Trek Voyager. Mm-hmm. He's in The West Wing.
Mm-hmm.
And, funny enough, you know, about 15 years later or so, he would have a little reunion with Scott Bakula on a show called Star Trek Enterprise when he...
still going to go down as the greatest Star Trek series ever.
Well, I don't know about that, but... but, yeah, he was in a few episodes, actually. Mm-hmm. He played the same character in the Augments storyline for mm-hmm. anyone who's... Again, following along.
Yeah, and he is also the guard on the train who inadvertently lets Harrison Ford get away in The Fugitive.
Fugitive, yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's the one that they're questioning where he makes up the story where he tries to prove his heroics, and then they find Harrison Ford's shackles and they realize that his story is bullshit.
Yeah.
And there's this great moment of, would you like to change your statement? What? And then Tommy Lee Jones says, would you like to change your bullshit story, sir?
Oh, man. Well, and then, of course, this leads, of course, to Sam actually getting...
getting released, yeah.
Released, yeah. And Al, you know, is just sort of like, oh, this is just a coincidence. But Sam doesn't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Sam thinks that maybe there's something more to
this. There's something going on. And there's a moment, I'm sure this was cut out in the reruns, where Al's like, hey, if you don't have anything, I'm just going to... And he just wanders off. He doesn't, you know, go through the imaging chamber door, pop out. He's like, I'm just going to go wander around 1953.
Yeah. Hang out.
But then we cut to Gotham Tower.
Yeah.
Which is actually the Bradbury Building in L.A.
Yep. Which was used in Blade Runner.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's a fairly iconic location, and you can see why. I mean, it's...
It is, which kind of surprises me, like, going back and watching it, why they would choose to use something that is such an iconic location, and probably a lot of people recognize it as being specifically L.A. specific,
right.
And they're supposed to be in...
In New York.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a very good question. I mean, it fits.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
I mean, I honestly didn't notice
mm-hmm.
that it was an LA location.
Yeah,
I did notice that this thought came up when I was watching the show. I'm like, oh my God, like they must have a crazy good budget because each episode takes place in a different time period and a different location.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't reuse sets, really.
Well, actually, you can. Like, me being a huge nerd, going back and watching, like, any time that there is a house set, after you've seen the episodes a few times, like, no, it's the same set. They just move pieces around. They redress it.
Yeah.
So there are some sets that they reuse. They've reused the courtyard from Back to the Future in several episodes. There's another courtyard that they've redressed and used in several episodes.
Okay.
But that said, I do think it's a good point that their resources clearly, though, had to be fairly high because they were able to replicate a lot of this stuff. And I think that for season two, the production values improve even.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the episodes, with the exception of Genesis, you know, in the first season, you do see a lot of stuff getting redressed. And you know, in... Double Identity, you clearly get the Hollywood backlot New York.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not, they're not even trying to, like, in this episode, they're trying to at least pretend that this is New York, whereas in Double Identity, it's so clearly the Hollywood backlot that at any moment, you know, you expect, like, the Keystone Cops to come walking by or something.
They did have difficulty from week to week, and I've seen it, like, written several places where, like, the cast and crew basically, I mean, like, they were basically making their own mini-movie
right.
from week to week mm-hmm. because they had to totally upend everything. And
yeah.
Well, yeah, you look at that apartment building that the guy lives in, and the guy who supposedly looks like Humphrey Bogart. I mean, that's a very specific apartment complex that he has to have, like, the specific kind of elevator for mm-hmm. the process of the storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, that takes a lot of time and money to, like, mm-hmm. find those kind of locations.
Yeah. Well, in that elevator shaft, though, it's a good point, because they could have, I mean, you could have used any elevator shaft, you know what I mean? Like, but it would not have been nearly as visually impressive.
Right.
Or quite, you know, as yeah. dramatic had it not been that elevator shaft. Mm-hmm. But not to get ahead of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. So he walks up to the Gotham Tower, and he has this other sense of deja vu that he's about to interact with someone named Seymour, who works with publishing, and he comes up on Seymour's newsstand, which is kind of like publishing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. yeah. And
it's like saying the guy that sells, you know, sneakers is in Foot Locker is in the NBA.
But eventually he isn't publishing.
But eventually, yeah. So, but eventually he does, yeah, he does yeah. get there. And Seymour is played by Willie Garson.
Yep.
Who most people would probably know him from Sex and the City. He played a character on that show.
Mm-hmm.
I did not watch Sex and the City regularly, so I have no idea. But he was a regular character on that show.
Yeah, I think he interacts a lot with Charlotte, if I remember right. I've not seen the show a lot, but I've seen enough to know that.
Oh, is he Steve?
Yeah, I think so, because he's bald in later life, or balding anyways in later life, and now he's on that show White Collar.
Okay.
But he also comes back.
He also comes back in a later season. As...
No, let's not tell him.
We're gonna
leave that one.
Yeah, we'll
tell you when we get there.
Yeah, but he pops back up.
He does,
as a pretty significant historical figure in a later episode.
Well, you've ruined it now.
We'll fix it in editing. No, we won't.
No, we're leaving it.
But he not only meets Seymour, but he meets Lionel, the mm-hmm. building superintendent, played by Paul Link,
mm-hmm.
Who was, like, he was one of those actors. He showed yep. up a lot then. He was on the TV show Chips. Did you
yes,
watch
that's
that?
Right.
Yes. My mom was a huge fan of that TV show.
Oh, yeah.
When I was a kid. And Chuck, the elevator man.
Steve Neville. I have no idea what else he's done. I just happen to see the next name.
Yeah. He pops up as Quantum Leap Conventions as Chuck the elevator.
Yeah, right.
But Chuck does have a line talking about Nick's dead partner, Phil.
Yeah.
It was just yesterday I was taking him up and down the elevator, and Lionel's like, it was just yesterday.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, and both also ask about Phil's widow.
Mm-hmm.
Allison,
mm-hmm.
Because clearly they're both fairly attracted to her. Pretty much everybody.
Yeah, it seems like everybody in the episode.
Yeah, and then Seymour gives us our first bit of, you know, hard boiled pulp speak, if you will, which as someone who's, you know, read his fair share of that sort of stuff, it very rarely actually is written this way.
Mm-hmm.
He says, a dropper named Clapper is responsible for mm-hmm. the murder.
Another title of this episode, they just called it a dropper named Clapper. But we'll get to that.
It's the adult
we'll get
that later version.
On. Yes. So at the end of this scene, Sam kind of makes a faux pas or does something out of character for Nick. He takes a paper and he actually pays for it.
Yeah.
And that kind of tips everybody off that there's something different about Nick.
Right. And Sam's just like, well, I figured I should start sometime mm-hmm. or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. And this is, then Seymour loses a lens out of his glasses, and we get the idea that this happens regularly, mm-hmm. and they place bets on how long it takes to get back in.
Yeah.
And this is also a thing, they do it occasionally, they don't do it often, that they put in like a comic sound effect.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, that's my son Harrison right there. But they put in the comic sound effect of the lens popping through the frame. There's like a boing.
Boing, yeah.
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 Well, and also the other thing that's nice too, to follow up on this, and this is something that we're going to see more and more and more, is that, you know, Sam is always obviously there to fight somebody, to correct some sort of injustice, fight for somebody, rather. But we really start to get the sense that he's got a soft spot for, you know, the little guy in particular. Mm,
yeah.
And here, you know, he bends down and he helps Seymour put the lens back in. And, you know, and clearly he's like, he's taken a bit of a liking already, you know, this kid. And it's like, okay, you know, And it makes you wonder, was Sam ever pushed into a locker when he was a kid? You know, I don't know.
Oh, I'm sure.
I mean, yeah, he was in college by the time he was, like, 16. I'm sure it wasn't always easy, so.
So I'm sure, yeah. He is not the the full-on Boy Scout that he does become in later seasons,
right.
But yeah. So we have this scene, Chuck takes Nick up on the elevator, and this awkward moment afterwards where Chuck throws out the idea that he's got two tickets to the Dodgers game. Do you think Allison would like to go to take her mind off of things?
Yeah.
Which, why is he asking him that question? Like, is it implied that people know about this relationship between him and Allison?
I think, in my mind, I just made it up that because it was Sam's partner, that they feel like they have to go through Sam, or Nick, rather, to get to Allison at this point. You know, like, he's...
Yeah.
All of a sudden become her.
And also, I think they're trying to establish the idea that a lot of men are attracted to Allison.
Yeah.
Maybe there are a lot of people who have motives for having killed
Phil. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, of course, Sam gets his sense of deja vu before he gets to his office as he walks away in disgust.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's thinking that somebody dangerous is in there.
Mm-hmm. And
opens the door. Who should be there?
Hello, Allison.
Yeah.
Claudia Christian, Babylon 5.
Indeed. Babylon 5. She also is in an episode of Highlander. In the last season of Highlander, quick television digression, they tried this thing where they were going to spin the show off with a new lead character, and they decided they wanted it to be a woman. So the last season of Highlander, a lot of people were, you know, expecting to get this shortened season, but at least get Adrian Paul in a lot of the episodes. He was really only in about 4 episodes in the last season. Every single other episode had a new immortal character played by a woman, and one of them was Claudia Christian, whose episode was arguably the best. For whatever reason, they didn't go with her. They decided to go with Elizabeth Grayson, who played Amanda throughout the series of the show anyway. And the show was terrible and horrible, and it lasted 1 season, and then was mercifully canceled, but, you know. Anyway.
Well, it freed her up to go into Babylon 5.
She'd already done Babylon 5.
Oh, that was already after that point.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
She's done a lot of work. Looked at her IMDb page.
Yeah, written a couple books, too, actually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, apparently they're very funny. I've not read them, but apparently they're very funny. Mm-hmm. She, I guess at one time, she had addiction problems and went to rehab and, you know, got everything sorted out and ended up writing a couple of books afterwards. And I guess they're very, very funny and honest and... You know, she seems like a cool person. She does, like, the convention circuit these days and all that sort of stuff, so...
Well, I mean, between Quantum Leap and Babylon 5 alone, I'm sure she has a lot of...
Right, yeah, absolutely.
Nerds from... Says the people on a Quantum Leap podcast.
I say that with love.
You wouldn't be sitting here otherwise, right?
So, they are... in his office. I think this is where we get the first oh boy of the episode.
I believe that is correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that like a thing?
That is a thing that they were starting to establish throughout the first season. Mm-hmm. And by 2 or 3 episodes or a handful of episodes in the second season, it'd be kind of become a trademark that every time he leaps into somewhere, he says, oh boy. And usually that it's the last line of every episode because the end of every episode is always showing where he leaps into next.
And now he's, I got to figure out what's going on. And, you know, there'd always be some sort of interesting position he would find himself in, you know. And then predictably and yet still surprisingly, I guess, she, you know, falls into his arms and now it's revealed that they've been... They've been having a bit of a thing.
They've been having a thing, but they've been having a thing, but they haven't.
A chaste version of a thing.
Yeah, a similarly chaste version, which may like they just limited to making out, but you know, obviously. And she has a line where I can't remember what they talk about, but she has a line where one night in bed, Phil was talking about because he was talking in his sleep.
Yeah.
Talking about a dropper named Clapper, and she drops, "Oh, you know, Phil and I slept in twin beds."
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
I thought that was a funny little aside.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, watch any TV show at the time, and married people always slept in twin beds, so, you know.
Actually, I've seen more than one thing out there that says that actually sleeping in separate beds leads to a happier marriage.
Really? It's an episode of How I Met Your Mother where that is not the case. In fact, they say the exact opposite.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know. As a wedding gift, Betsy and I bought each other a king size bed.
Beautiful.
And it is the best gift that we've ever given each other.
Yeah. One of these days.
Besides your child, of course. It's a king size bed.
And he cuts it right to the heart.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, so they have this discussion of where Allison is going to stay now, and she would like to stay with Nick. And
yeah.
Since Phil is gone, now they can finally
be together.
They can finally consummate their relationship. And then they have a pretty nice kiss, little makeout session here. And something I hadn't noticed in a previous viewing, like during this, she just reaches right into his coat pocket and grabs the keys out of his pocket.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and this is also where we get that moment too, where after the kiss, she walks out and Sam looks up to the heavens and says
thank you. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. She has that great line. What was it? It was something like, I could never love a man who I thought killed my husband or something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm like, wow, how noble of you. Like,
right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that he's gone now so we can have this, but yeah.
Well, it's nice to know there's a line, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So she leaves. Sam has that thank you moment up to the heavens. He takes off his gun. He puts it in his desk drawer, and that's when he finds a manuscript. And he starts reading it. And that's when he realizes that it's not deja vu. He's read this book.
Yep. Yeah. Which is an interesting little twist, because even Jess, quite honestly, did not make it through the whole episode with me. She didn't fall asleep, but before that happened, she'd fallen asleep by this point, but she'd stayed awake long enough to hear the deja vu stuff. And so she asked me, she's like, is this going to be like a recurring thing? Like, is he going to like have premonitions now throughout the show or whatever? And I was like, no.
Yeah,
and
that's what I was wondering too.
No, this isn't that. But it's funny though, because it is something that gets played with in other episodes. Not him specifically having premonitions necessarily, but the fact that he has some sort of knowledge or awareness, or, you know, it gets turned on its ear. There's a couple of episodes.
I'm also wondering if him having a deja vu, it's kind of playing with some trope in film noir that I'm not as familiar with. And this just occurred to me because in the film noirish type show that Annie and I were in together, there was a similar kind of thing.
Sure.
And the guy who wrote the play, he was obviously very into film noir. So I'm wondering if that's playing into a trope that I am not quite aware of.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I know that, you know, obviously there's a lot of memory is something that gets played with a lot in film noir. But I don't know. I don't know. I know that there's a film. It might have been even titled Deja Vu. Now I can't remember. But apparently the British Film Institute put out an infographic that broke down film noir into its essential elements, and one of those was indeed a sense of deja vu.
Ooh, okay.
So there we go.
There we go.
Thanks
all
to
right.
the BFI.
Thank
we now
you.
Know. Yeah.
Thank you, BFI. So we go to commercial break and we come back, and so Sam is looking over the manuscript. Al appears. I just want to make note about Al's outfit being gray with like the shiny buttons up the front.
Yes.
In seventh grade, I went as Al for Halloween, and my outfit was very much modeled on this particular. It wasn't an exact copy, but it was
Wait,
very much modeled
on. How many people
on.
Knew who you were?
me and Mrs. Pringle.
Nice.
Who was also a Quantum Leap fan.
And was your teacher, right?
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Also my English teacher. Thank you very much. So in this conversation, we find that Sam is starting to fall for Allison.
He falls fast.
He does. Yeah. And so he wants Al to go back and find this book. And start to find out what's going on. And he has this line in here about, you know, who murdered Phil. And he says, we've got Clapper. And Al responds, careful, there was no cure for that in 1953.
Right. Not entirely true, but, you know, that's all right.
That's all right. I knew that the clap was an STD. I had to go look up which one.
Gonorrhea.
It is. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, it sure is.
Gonorrhea. And so just stumbling upon why gonorrhea came to be known as the clap, I found a couple of different theories on that. One is that the clap could be derivative of the French word clapier, which is brothel.
Ah, all right.
Or a more widely held belief is that one of the earlier treatments for gonorrhea was clapping or slamming a heavy object,
no.
such as a book,
no.
onto the penis to to force discharge, to force discharge out.
Oh.
If you like to listen to Fate by Will while you have your morning breakfast in your office, we apologize.
Oh,
write us
man.
Hate mail to @FatesWideWheel, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook.
The more you know.
Yes, the more you know. Yeah.
In this case, the less I know as well.
Yeah. So anyway, so Sam gives Al the directive to go back and find this book because he can't remember how it ended. And we find that the name of the manuscript right now is Dead Men Don't Die.
Dead men don't die.
And they make the joke that, yeah, probably wasn't published under that thing. But you know what? Bob Fisher, who wrote the play that we were in, I bet you he would write a play called Dead Men Don't Die.
It actually does legitimately sound like a
He would not
title.
Be like, I mean, the film noirish play that we were in together was called Devils Don't Forget.
Oh, well, there you have it.
So
Don't Forget.
Yeah, which is not too far removed from Dead Men
don't
die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, going back to the whole Casablanca thing, though. Too though, it's the idea that you know, film titles like Out of the Past and Double Indemnity, and you know, and all these wonderful other. It's like Touch of Evil. You know, those were fresh, popping film titles.
Right.
You know, in the late 40s, early 50s. Nowadays, you look at that, it's like, oh, is that really?
Is that a thing? Yeah, it is. So as we pull away from the scene, like there's a wider shot of the office, and I just have noticed in the background, Nick Allen has a framed newspaper of Dillinger being killed.
Yep.
Dillinger killed. And I looked it up. That was not the New York Times headline that day. But it was just interesting that Nick Allen decided to have
wasn't
that
Dillinger
framed in his office.
In Chicago?
He was,
yeah.
in front of the
yeah.
Biograph.
That's right.
Which would have been in 1934. Hmm. 19 years before this episode.
Yeah. It is interesting that, but I noticed that too. I, it's just a little cool nod, I guess, to his crime fighting job.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The art designer on this episode, if they ever tune in, will be very pleased to hear that we were talking
that we caught that there. So I think, yeah, from there we go to, I think a commercial break. Or no. From there, he decides he's going to be sliding out and leaving. We have this nice moment as he's leaving the office. He tries on different hats. And the first hat he tries on is not his. Actually, he puts
Phil's,
it back on.
Yeah.
He goes, Phil's.
Yeah.
And so, again, we've talked about before, like, how do other people's clothes fit on Sam? What do people see? What does he feel? And so,
Yeah.
Interesting how... Nick's hat just fits very easily on his head.
Yes, it does. Do we talk about also in the book, knowing that that this is all coming from a book that you know, Sam finds out that, you know, because his memory of the book that Nick and Allison were deeply in love,
mm-hmm.
that they were too loyal to Phil act on their feelings, and that he believes that he's got to find a killer so that they can live happily ever after. So he asks Al to locate a copy of it in the future. But like you were saying, it didn't get published under that title, so Al's going to have some difficulty finding that.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's leaving the office, and when he leaves the office, Seymour stops him.
Mm-hmm.
And tells him that
a friend gave him a tip.
Yeah,
something about
the Blue Island.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Seymour asks Sam if he has his gun, and Sam comments that no, the police have it.
Yeah,
and we just saw it.
Sam put it
in his desk.
Yeah,
and so this is in the Matt Dale trivia book. It's noted as a goof.
Mm.
But in the novelization of this episode, which was more widely released. Actually, I don't think it was ever officially released in the U.S. It was it was released in the U.K. In the novelization, they make it more clear that Sam is lying to Seymour when he says, the cops have his gun. Kind of makes you wonder, just Sam, is Sam not comfortable with the idea of carrying a gun?
Or he's trying to figure out who he can trust in this world.
Yeah. It is interesting because it's not, I mean, he carried a gun in double identity, you know? We'll see him with a gun again.
Later on.
Yeah.
But anyway, as they're having this conversation, Sam almost gets Rosalind Shade.
What?
That's a reference Sam gets, the reference Annie does again.
Sam is sitting over here cracking up the door.
Harrison gets it.
Harrison gets it. That's my boy. So Rosalind Shade was a character on the TV series L.A. Law.
Okay.
And I don't know what led to the character getting killed off, but the character was eventually killed off of the show, and the way they killed her off was she was talking with another colleague, and elevator doors open, she goes to step on the elevator's not there, and she falls down the elevator shaft.
Yeah.
That's how they very unceremoniously killed Rosalind Shade off of L.A. Law.
Because it was the thing is it's like, and you can even see the clip of it on YouTube, is it so low-key. She's literally just having a regular old conversation with somebody. The elevator dings, the doors open, and she just like turns around, and, you know, and is like waving goodbye. And just, it's almost funny. You know, it's almost
they don't shoot it in a way to telegraph that something bad's about to happen. She just falls down.
So did something like happen with the actress where they're like, we need to get this chick off the show?
No, I don't know. That's a really good question, but I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I can't remember. Anyway. It's the same actress who played Dr. Pulaski on the second season of. On the second season of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yep.
But anyway, Sam almost gets Rosalind Shade, but he catches himself, pulls himself back up. He turns around to say something to Seymour, and it turns out Seymour has passed out.
Is that what happened? I was so confused. I was like, why is he all of a sudden, like, on the floor asleep?
And for a minute, I can even remember, like, thinking, did somebody knock him out? Like, knock him out to try to finish the job on Sam? Or, you know, but yeah.
I've always just taken it as he just got so overwhelmed by the excitement, he just passed out.
And well, it's odd, though, because they don't ever really talk about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it seems very convenient, because the thing that the episode does, and it's like, it almost forces its hand when trying to make you suspicious of everyone. Like, even, like, you turn around and you see Seymour, like, passed out on the wall with no explanation. It's like, wait a minute. You know? I mean, there are times in this episode when you think, like, Seymour might be behind some of this stuff. I don't know. It just doesn't hold up.
How do you feel? So anyway, so we have the scene back and where Lionel and Chuck are back on the scene, and Chuck is saying, like, this shouldn't happen. The elevator door shouldn't open. Unless the elevator is there.
And the safety latch is broken.
Or I think Lionel may say that, and then Chuck says, well, I told you, it's an old elevator. It needs to be serviced, so.
Right. Well, and Lionel gets mad and blames it all on Chuck, and you know, says it's his fault because he's not doing his job monitoring the lift and everything. Yeah. And then Seymour, and then again, this is one of those things where it just feels like they're just like kind of just really pushing it on us, because Seymour's like, oh, you know, I'm sorry, and I've always been a jinx.
Yeah,
and it's just sort of like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, though, Seymour tells a little sweet bit about, you know, being raised in an orphanage when he's a kid. And...
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Seymour is basically like a caricature in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which they talk about, which he... Sam references later in the episode, be like, nobody could possibly be as nerdy,
dorky, dopey, wussy. Yeah, he just like goes down the
list later on. At least I'm like not
not alone in this. Yeah,
right. Mm-hmm. Not alone in this thinking.
But anyway, so they Nick and Seymour, or Nick as Sam and Seymour, going down the stairs, and that's when they run into Allison. And Seymour has a line of basically like Nick is great or Nick is awesome. I can't remember exactly what the line is, but Seymour says, you know, you know, you're Nick Allen, you're the best. That's it. You're Nick Allen, you're the best. To get to the bottom of the stairs, and Allison says, that's what I've always said. And she's in this.
Yeah,
she's in this very stunning dress. I think we get a joint. Oh boy, from Sam and Seymour. And then we have this scene where they argue about whether or not it's safe to go to the Blue Island or not.
Yep.
And I don't know if you remember this, But in reruns, in syndication, this scene is cut out.
Oh, really? Okay.
In reruns, it goes from Allison saying, "That's what I've always said," and there's just this nice crossfade to them dancing at the Blue Island. And typically, I'm a completionist, and I want to see all the scenes, but that, like, watching that scene where they're arguing about whether or not it's safe to go to the Blue Island, I'm like, this is such a time-filling, pointless scene. Yeah. Why is it here? It's one of those moments like, no, it's much better when they just do the crossfade and they cut straight to the Blue Island.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have a hard time really putting my finger on it, but there are some issues with this episode, and I think that might be revealing in and of itself, you know, with the fact that you didn't need that moment, and you could have gone just straight to the Blue Island, and it would have been fine. Mm-hmm. You know, would have quickened the pace, obviously, and gotten us there, and, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, it was odd that they kept talking about the Blue Island, and the Blue Island, and then, like, it turns out the Blue Island, nothing, it didn't even really matter in the episode, like, at all.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it was a nice set piece.
It's just that the episode, like I said, sometimes it feels like it just can't decide whether it wants to be this sort of farcical parody of film noir, or if it wants to be film noir, and that takes me out of it on occasion, you know?
Yeah.
Because there are some great moments, and then there are some moments where you're just sort of like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Blue Island.
So they're dancing, and Sam has this voiceover where, you know, he doesn't know, you know, what to believe, whether if Allison is being so close to him because she wants to feel safe and protected, or maybe she's the killer. And she's keeping a close watch on him. And
yet he's so, like, he fights so much against that notion anytime, you know, Al, like, brings
he's
it up.
He's, like, so unwilling to believe it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we'll come to that moment here in a second. So, yeah, he looks over, he spots Al
conducting
the band.
Yeah, which is great. Yeah,
which is a fun moment. And so he sits Allison down with Seymour, so Seymour can bore her to death with... with stories of Tommy Trueblood, which I looked up is not an actual series at all. When I Googled that, I got a lot of hits for the TV series Trueblood.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And there, apparently there's a character of Tommy on there. So we have this scene of Sam sitting in the bar and Al talking. It turns out this book that Sam read was a murder contest books that were,
like,
really big in the
50s.
And Al says it so nonchalantly that I've always just taken it for granted. Like, oh, I guess this is kind of a weird, creepy thing that they did.
Yeah.
But looking it up, no.
Couldn't find anything.
Yeah. If these things existed, they've been completely lost to history, and there's nothing on the internet.
Interesting.
About it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would... not have a hard time believing that they existed, but I guess if there's no evidence.
Well, was it supposed to be that the crimes were real?
The crimes were unsolved mysteries.
Right.
And they kind of novelized the story, and if you could figure out who the murderer was. And I guess if you provided a tip or you figured something out, you got a $10,000 prize.
Which is funny because there's also that moment where, you know, Sam's like, "Did anybody figure it out?" And Al's like, "Yeah, you know, they guessed everybody from the Pope to Joseph Stalin or something."
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. But most people guessed it was
Allison.
Yeah.
And he notices that the title of the book is called "Who Killed Grimsley and Alan?"
Yeah, Grimsley and Alan. Well, I will say, though, that I do have some vague recollection of, you know, they were really popular right up there with like, you know, your comic books or whatever, but there were all these sort of, like, trashy, pulpy kind of crime magazines, and they did do that. They did have, like, you know, they'd run real crime stories, real, you know, stories, and then ask you to, like, figure it out. And, of course, I mean, it was so laughable to think that anybody would be able to figure it out from a short write-up in a magazine
for sure
or whatever.
You know, now
we do have the show Unsolved Mysteries.
Unsolved Mysteries. And it just occurred to me, probably the closest modern day equivalent, it's not a contest or asking people to write in, but it certainly invites for input and invites for the audience to be a part of the story, is Serial.
Yeah.
That's true.
The first season.
God, any of those, like, I mean, and they've gotten so bad and salacious, but like the 48 hours or the Datelines or like any of those sorts of stuff. I mean, these days they've got
Rescue 911, well, starring William Shatner.
Sure. But that was like, you know, reenactments and stuff. But no, I mean, like these days, if you watch Dateline or 48 hours and they do like their mystery of the week thing, they, you know, they'll give you all the details of these horrible crimes that have happened and interview all these people. And nowadays, because of social media, they'll ask for like your opinion and they'll come back with an infographic of like, you know, 43% of our viewers on Twitter think that blah 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 was responsible for the murder. And it's like,
my favorite are when they ask for like a Facebook reaction. They're like, give us an angry face if you think she did it. It's like, oh god,
this is the world in which we live.
Do you think Jesus did it? Type amen. I may be mixing something up. Total tangent. There was a family in my hometown that was featured on Unsolved Mysteries.
Oh man!
They did, but it's a really creepy way the way they solved it. So in the late 1980s, a guy from my hometown, he actually grew up in my church. His parents went to my church. He was murdered walking to his car one night in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh man!
He was murdered like as he was getting into his vehicle, and he worked for some music magazine in Nashville.
Okay.
And it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries. Nothing was solved from there. Then about 8-10 years later, somebody on his deathbed wanting to clear his conscience revealed the reason why he was killed, and it turns out this guy had uncovered this entire scheme where record companies were paying to get their songs placed on the Billboard charts, and he was about to blow the whistle. And somebody hired the person who was on his deathbed, who eventually confessed, somebody hired this guy to kill him to keep him from blowing the whistle.
Payola, man. It's a killer.
Yeah. Anyway, so, but who killed Grimsley and Alan is the book. And so, like Annie was saying, like, Al is kind of needling at Sam about, like, I think you're letting your judgment get clouded here.
Right. And it's crazy because Al even comes up with, like, this theory, which, again, you know, I feel like they've kind of tried to force upon us a little bit about how Allison, you know, was responsible for the murders, and that she and Seymour run off together at LaGuardia.
Yeah.
It's like,
which even then, like in the writing of the episode, like, they don't even try to play that could be a realistic scenario.
Yeah.
At all. Because while this is going on, they keep cutting back to Allison and Seymour, and Seymour is just boring the crap out of Allison. But the thing is, like, he's boring the crap out of her, but not in a creepy
malicious way.
Not in a malicious way. Like, you never really get the idea that Seymour is going to kidnap
Allison. Right.
Yeah. Well, I kept waiting for, like, Seymour to take his glasses off and be, like, this huge babe. And then it's like, oh, yeah, they're going to get on a plane, and they're going to go to wherever together.
He does the Christopher Reeve, you know, where he's like, he squares the shoulders.
As he is, like,
brushes his hair back.
Right.
But there, so there is this thing where Al tells Sam, like, I think your judgment's getting clouded. Or your instincts are getting clouded. I can't remember how he says it, but Sam,
he says you're using your hormones to guide your thinking,
your instinct or something. Yeah. And Sam is Al saying something about your instincts, and Sam says your instincts got you married 5 times. And I was like, oh, that your Swiss cheese brain remembers. Well, let me tell you something, pal. You haven't been getting any lately. And that's when Sam fires back. Don't compare to me to yourself. I think with my brain, I don't cloud my judgment with a bottle.
Okay. I didn't think the 5 times thing got brought up yet.
I'm pretty, I think, because it noted, because, like, I think this is the first time, because, like, they make allusion to Al's ex-wives before, and you don't know how many he has, and I think this is the first time they made it clear that Al has been married 5 times.
5 times, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's just, like, usually the language of Quantum Leap doesn't just come flat out and say, you haven't been getting any lately.
Yeah.
That seems like such a very blunt line, like, out of character for the show overall. It just kind of
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's an interesting little blow up between the two of them, mm-hmm. you know, and clearly Sam is very taken with Allison, and it's something that, you know, I certainly took note of, that, you know, Sam is smitten with Allison. It's interesting that he's so drawn in by mm-hmm. her.
Yeah, she doesn't really even, like, say that much.
No.
I mean, it's one of those things. It's one of those things where everybody, like, you just have to take the context of everybody's lines of how attractive and how much she draws everybody in,
yeah.
without really doing the work of writing her as a necessarily
right.
compelling character yeah. outside of her looks.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, again, I think that, you know, Claudia Christian has enough sort of depth, you know, there's enough going on.
Yeah, she's
on.
A lot of charisma. Then.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But.
Right, but it is still very much a case of sort of like, she doesn't get a lot else. You know, she's not getting a lot of help from mm-hmm. the writers on being this, like, say, compelling, interesting character.
Mm-hmm. But also, like, this blow-up that Sam and Al have, it's the first time we've seen since the pilot where they reference how much Al drinks.
Yeah, that's
because
true.
In the pilot, he shows up in virtually every scene either drunk or hungover, and this is the first time it's brought up again, and aside from one episode, like, in the fourth season, like, this is the last time it's brought up how much Al drinks.
Yeah.
Which I think is something that they, thankfully, they kind of eventually drop off.
Yeah, it does get brought up a few other times throughout the show, but you're right, it's not something that they... Yeah, it's not something that's constantly hammered at you that, you know, Sam's, or that Al, rather, is a drunkard by any means.
Mm-hmm. But Al handles it kind of gracefully, and he parts ways. He's like, hey, you know, just a bit of advice, don't go near LaGuardia, because that's where you're supposed to be killed.
Right.
You know who Al kind of reminds me of is that one actor who... can't think of his name, but he's on Chicago Fire, and he was, like, a Scientologist, and he's been on, like, the Leah Remini documentaries.
Mm-mm.
Do you know who I'm talking about?
I have
that
no
guy
idea.
Is, like, the really gravelly voice.
Mm-mm.
I think I do know who you're talking about, because I think he was on Californication for a few episodes, actually.
He's been on a lot of stuff. I just know him from the Scientology thing. And Chicago Fire. Yeah, I gotta look it up.
Yeah. So after Al disappears, like, Sam has this, like, moment of introspection where, yeah, it's like, you know, why do we hurt people for telling us the truth? And he said, but he admits that Al is right, that Allison has them all turned around, and I can't remember the exact way he puts it, but he throws out a simile worthy of Seymour, and he's like, oh God, I'm talking like Seymour now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then we have this moment where he walks by the band with the drinks, and he's mistaken for Bogey.
And they start playing As Time Goes By.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and Sam just has this great moment of, like, I'm not...
Yeah. So they step outside. A thunderstorm is starting. Seymour says he's going to go over on Madison to catch a cab. And this gives Sam and Allison a moment to have a little snuggle time.
Right.
He goes off to find a cab himself. He gets shot at. The neon sign blows up in his cheek, so he gets a little cut on his cheek.
Yep.
Then they have another little makeup moment. And then Seymour finally pulls up in the taxi. And this whole thing kind of throws up the idea. Was Seymour delayed getting the taxi because he was the one taking a shot at him?
Right. Yeah, you know, and again, it's interesting because, again, I don't think it's anything that I wasn't expecting that this would be thrown out there at some point or another. Mm-hmm. Just from, you know, the way that, I don't know, that everything else has been kind of, anybody could be guilty,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, I feel like the way the show is written, or the episode was written, is that they keep pointing you to a couple specific people, like to Allison and to Seymour,
mm-hmm.
but then the person who it actually ends up being, I didn't notice them pointing the finger towards him at all, which maybe we'll talk about later. But
no, absolutely we will, but you're right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, it is interesting that there is this sort of thought that it could be anybody, and yet at the same time, we're being given the spotlight on these other two characters, you know, Allison and Seymour in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. So anyway, so they get into the cab,
mm-hmm.
and Seymour just keeps laying the similes on heavy, and this is when Sam finally blows up. We had the moment we were talking about earlier, like, no one can be as nerdy as you.
And they look at him like, nerdy,
what is that? Yeah. Dorky, dweeby, wussy.
Yeah.
Mm. And this is when Sam's like, he's got to figure out he's not going to be Philip Marlowe, as the name he throws out, Humphrey Bogart, or Thomas Magnum. Yeah.
And they're both like, who?
Yeah. Which is also a hat tip to the same guy who created Quantum Leap, also created Magnum P.I.
Yeah.
Yeah. Didn't watch that show either.
Mm. And that was one. It's interesting because they also establish in another later episode, Magnum P.I., the TV show, does exist in the quantum
realm. Yeah.
In the Quantum Leap realm.
Right.
Did they ever have, like, crossover episodes?
Funny that you should mention.
There was going to be an episode in the last season. They were going to have Sam leap into Magnum, and it just. It didn't come together.
Yeah, for some reason. Never
came they even like did like a test filming of Sam looking at the camera and giving Thomas Magnum's famous like eyebrow.
Yeah, yeah.
And it just didn't. There was one story going around that Tom Selleck didn't want to do it, be the mirror image basically. And Tom Selleck he denied like ever having known anything about it. So.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe Tom Selleck's agent didn't want him to do it. Yeah.
I mean, what else was he really doing at the time? But, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Speaking of crossovers, it was Chicago PD,
mm-hmm.
and his name is Jason Beghe. I could be pronouncing that wrong. But anyway.
Oh, no. He's the lead.
Yeah.
He's the lead of Chicago PD.
Yeah.
He actually pops up in a later very iconic episode of Quantum Leap.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. And then he took...
He's telling me it's as, like, Al's alter ego.
No. But he shows up as a somewhat minor character. Okay. A supporting character,
mm-hmm.
in that episode. And then he quit acting for 25 years. And then he came back as the lead in Chicago PD.
Yeah.
Or Chicago Fire.
No, he's
apparently, because those shows are so interchangeable to me.
Yeah, right.
I think you're right in that Chicago Fire was the first one that started,
and then
Chicago PD spun off of it. So I'm sure he did a couple guest starring episodes on Fire before going to PD.
Well, like I said, right before that, like literally right before that, he'd done a few episodes on a season of Californication.
Okay.
Quite hilarious as a nice foil for David Duchovny's lead.
I would love to see him in something else, because he doesn't have much to do in the episode of Quantum Leap that he's in.
Yeah.
But in Chicago PD, it's such a stylized thing where he's down here and he talks like this.
Oh, yeah.
And they so badly want him to be Mike Chiklis from The Shield, but it's NBC, so he can't. So he can't be Mike Chiklis from The Shield. Like sometimes they allude to the things that he used to do. Or might do, to get his way.
But
he never crosses that line because it's NBC and not FX. Yeah,
sure. Hmm. Well, and you know, they get cooperation from the city of Chicago that they might not otherwise get should they decide to. For instance, one of the things that the Shield had to do, a lot of people might not know, is that because the LAPD was so upset, they had to have they wear the badge on the opposite side of their chest,
mm-hmm.
Because they wouldn't allow
to distance
them
themselves as much as
because they threatened them with like lawsuits and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But back to Quantum Leap. Seymour's feelings are hurt. He's kind of devastated by this.
So Sam stops by his office basically to get his gun, most importantly, but also grab a hat and coat for Allison on the way out.
It's raining and everything.
Yeah.
Wait, how did he retrieve his hat? Because it fell down the elevator shaft. Was that ever shown in the episode? Because he has it for the rest of the episode.
I think, because it falls down the elevator shaft, and then I think there's a little bit of a show, like, somehow Chuck got it out of the shaft later on, because I think he's getting his hat handed back to him in the scene immediately following him, almost falling down the elevator shaft.
Okay.
I think. But he's getting the other hat and coat for Allison.
Okay.
So he walks back out, and Seymour's back at his newsstand, and Seymour's just going to... You know,
he's
back.
Very upset. He's very crying. His glasses are broken again.
Yeah, his glasses pop out again, and that's what causes Sam to turn around. And this is another interesting moment. Sam lights a cigarette and starts smoking.
Yeah.
And Betsy and I were watching it together. She was like, does Sam smoke?
No.
And I'm like...
In the episode immediately prior to this, he spits one out in disgust.
Yeah. And I like in a later episode, like, he's pretty anti-smoking.
Oh, yeah.
And this one, just because, you know, they're leaning so heavily into the...
Sure.
Into the genre, he just...
Right.
Lights up.
Which I do. I feel like had this episode come later in the run, that it... You know, that would not have happened.
They would have played with that somehow.
Exactly. They would have played with it a different way, because I think once, you know, once the character is really truly, truly established, which is going to happen soon enough, I think that they would usually mold situations within an episode to fit the character, as opposed to allowing the character to just fit any situation. And in the first season, there's a lot of times when I feel like they use Sam as this cipher to just kind of fit into any situation.
Yeah.
And to me, the show doesn't work that way. The show works much better when Sam is Sam, and the situations, you know, are dictated by his actions, as opposed to the other way around.
That was actually a question that I had in regards to, like, the personality of the body that he's inhabiting. Like, how much of that he takes on himself. Because the episode, you know, I felt like he did take on some of the personality traits, but then others were just him being him. So yeah. It seemed like a little bit of half and half.
You know, that's a very valid question, because there are some episodes in the run of the show where they do play around with that, where there are, like, bits and pieces of the other person that kind of Sam takes on.
Especially last season, they lean into that.
We'll talk more about that.
We'll get to that later. So
he apologizes. They make up.
Yeah. So while all this is going on, a taxi pulls up behind the taxi that Allison is waiting in, and they cut back. Sam and Seymour are walking out. Seymour wants to come along. Sam says, okay, on two conditions. One, you listen to my instructions to the letter. Two, go get a raincoat. And the raincoat thing is just clear, like, he's planning on ditching Seymour just to keep him safe.
Yeah.
He walks out, and then we get this nice shot where we see someone getting in the taxi, and we think it's Sam. But then the taxi pulls away and Sam walks out. And so who got into the taxi with Allison?
Right.
Giving Seymour time to catch up.
Yep. And then and now all of a sudden, you know, they realize that they've got to go after it, because Sam is pretty sure that the killer is in that cab. And at this point, I think he's finally starting to give into the notion that Allison could indeed be, if not the killer, in league with the killer. And, you know, it's great, because we get this nice moment in the cab on the way to LaGuardia where Al shows up.
And Sam kind of does this dual conversation.
Because he's even, I think he says to Seymour at one point that he's hurt two friends tonight or something like that. And now he takes the opportunity to, you know, make up with both of them. And, of course, Al is very concerned, though, that he's going to LaGuardia. He's like, please tell me you're not going, you know. Where's this cab headed? And yeah, you know, it's interesting, because now Sam seems a lot more serious, I think, after getting shot at than he had prior to that. Not that he'd been, like, the goofy Sam that we get in other first season episodes or whatever, but I just think that now all of a sudden there's, like, this sort of very serious kind of, like, oh, I could wind up dead.
Yeah, he is much more hard-boiled.
Yes, indeed.
So that's a possibility in the realm of this universe that he could die in somebody else's body?
Yeah.
Yes.
It has not been, you know, and this is one of those things that I'm okay with us talking about, because I think because it's a conceit of the whole show, but it's not been firmly established yet, but it will be that it's actually his physical presence that is leaping. Even though he does, you know, he takes on the appearance of the other person, it's technically like his body.
He is surrounded by the aura of the person that he's leaped into.
So he can be hurt, and he can, you know, he can die. Yeah. And that's something that Bella's
hurt.
And that's something that Belisario even, I think, cops to early on as well. Like, he was asked that question, and he was like, no, Sam could die.
Yeah. Like, he set it up like, if Sam leaps into someone with a broken leg, Sam doesn't have a broken leg. But if Sam gets his leg broken during a leap, Sam has a broken leg.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, and at this point, of course, you know, Sam admits to Al that, like, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe Allison did it.
Yeah. And then they have this scene where Sam and Seymour are about to split up, and Sam throws out the word, if you eyeball my main squeeze. And I can't remember what the rest of the thing is, but main squeeze is a term that Seymour has not heard before.
Yeah.
And after Seymour walks away, Sam and Al have this moment where Al is like, I'm just trying to figure out how in 20 years, Main Squeeze gets from Seymour to wherever it ends up going. He said, like, I went back and I could not figure out what Al says in that.
I didn't catch it either. Because I was wondering the same thing. I'm like, what did he say?
I should watch with the captions on, but... But anyway, so now they are in the terminal for LaGuardia, and Sam's cover is blown by a kid, mistaking him for Bogey.
Yeah.
And did you get who this kid was supposed to be?
No. Who's he supposed
to be? It's not very clear.
Woody Allen.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did they leap there? Okay, well, I guess I could see that now. But why Woody Allen?
Well, there's a Woody Allen play called Play It Again, Sam, where the main character talks with, like, the ghost of Humphrey Bogart in order to get, like, confidence and that sort of stuff. Kid even says at one point, he's like, you know, in my dreams I talk to you, or, you know, sometimes I talk to you in my bedroom at night or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, you know, his mother's given him all sorts of a hard time. And he has a couple of, like, Woody Allen-esque mannerisms down there. Right. But,
now thinking back, yeah, I could see that.
Yeah.
But this is where we see that Lionel is also in the terminal, in hiding, wearing a hat and a trench coat. And Seymour runs into him. Lionel, what are you doing here? And that's when Lionel pulls a gun and escorts Seymour out. Meanwhile, Al has gone off to the ladies' room to look for Allison.
Yeah.
Because somebody's got to do it.
That's right, exactly. And yeah, so we get this... the end of that Woody Allen moment I just wanted to go back to real quick is very funny to me because the women blame Woody Allen for scaring Bogey off because you know he's like yeah I gotta go and then they all get like mad at him and like his mother like actually like slaps him or something which is you know easily plays into all the neuroses that we know that he and his characters would have for years to come. But yeah, so Seymour's been forced out and
so now we get into the gunfight.
Yeah, and
this
is a really cool moment because Al like plays a big part into you know helping Sam through this and I really like the way that it's done because it's not something that we see a lot of prior to this. I mean, yes, in the pilot, you know, he helps Sam with the fly the plane and that sort of stuff.
And it also follows the trend that I've pointed out before of Al showing up about 2 minutes after after he really should have shown up. He just launched along like, hey, oh, there's a gunfight. What's going on? Where is he? What's going on? And I put out a moment on social media asking people their favorite moments. And Rachel Rosen, who's the co-host of another Quantum Leap podcast, Back to the Future, she also threw out, like, she really likes this moment of...
Yeah.
Of Al fully using his abilities as a hologram
It's great, too, because he's, like, insulting Lionel as Lionel's, like, shooting through him. I mean, obviously he doesn't see Al standing there, but, like, the bullets are, like, firing through Al. And, you know, and Al's like, you couldn't hit, you know, it's just...
Couldn't hit an elephant in a tunnel.
Yeah, there you go.
The food in his mustache. But also they have a nice moment of Lionel is suffocating Seymour, and he's saying, like, Allison and I just want to be together. You have to face the truth. She never loved you. And then in the background, like... Because I knew it was coming, I was watching for it. Like, in the background, you can see Allison's silhouette sitting there, and then the camera slowly pans in, and you can see she's
like, bound and gagged. Yeah. And then finally, like, you know, he runs out of bullets, and Al is very much like, Sam, you gotta get here, he's reloading, he's like, where are you, and all of a sudden you see Sam's hand, like, from underneath.
The gun.
Yeah, with the gun. Like,
don't even think about it, you mug.
Yeah, and then that's another opportunity for Al to say, that's Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah.
And then we get the arrest, Lionel is carted off, and now we have our, real Casablanca
moment. But there is a line where Allison is looking after Lionel and wonders, like, how could I turn him on so much and not realize it? And Sam, Scott Bakula just has this look on his face like, are you serious? Do you not get how hot you are?
Yeah.
And so they are going to get on the plane. They have two tickets to somewhere, tickets that Phil bought before he died. And Allison admits that it's kind of...
Wait, it was Phil? I thought it was the dude that kidnapped her. What's his name?
Lionel.
Oh, Lionel. That's right. Oh, you're right. You are right.
Oh, yeah.
Booyah. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah, because she talks about, oh, his poor soul, like, I didn't, you know, mm-hmm. I feel bad for him mm-hmm. and whatnot.
That's right. Makes a lot more sense. But anyway, so they're going to go over to Lionel, who's taking them.
Yeah, and now we get this great, you know, where Sam is excited because he's going to get on this plane with Allison, and they're going to go off and, you know, be happy.
That's another thing, like, where does Sam think this is going?
Yeah.
Like, usually, like, every episode, like, he knows, like, as soon as he accomplishes the thing, he's going to leap. Like, what?
And Al has to reinforce, he's like, you know, no, you're here. You're not getting on this plane. And, you know, and then, you know, he quotes the line from Casablanca, and, you know, maybe not today, and maybe not, but... And then they walk out, and Seymour's, you know, it stops him. You know, and Allison goes to get on the plane.
Yeah, but they have this. Yeah, they have this great moment where Seymour realizes, like, I think up until that point, like, he really wanted to live the gumshoe life, and now having gone through it in this last few hours, he's like
I don't want to do this.
Just much more fun to read about it. And then offhand, Sam just says or write about it.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and that lights the fire.
And Seymour
walks off, like, narrating this last scene, and I was like, you're here to launch a new pulp novelist.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, you know, he turns around and gets another look at Allison as she's boarding the plane, and then...
I like how she also mentions that it's a sleeper plane.
That's right. man. And then, unfortunately for Sam, he does indeed leap out. Now, here's something interesting, however.
Mm-hmm.
He leaps into a woman in a bathtub.
Mm-hmm. Someone in a bathtub.
That's right.
Someone in a bathtub.
Well, right. But you find out by the end of the
mm-hmm.
the scene that he's leapt into a woman.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is this is not at all the next episode that we see.
Mm-hmm.
So, quick piece of trivia is that What Price Gloria was indeed going to be the next episode aired as the season 2 premiere. It had already been shot as a part of the season 1 block, but they were going to air it as the season 2 premiere.
Mm-hmm.
Because of everything that had happened in the meantime, and I think this kind of is something that we'll talk more about next week, Belisario writes this other episode... kind of addressing some of the issues that he was even having with the network about making sure that Quantum Leap could continue.
Mm-hmm.
They figured it was a much better, much stronger opener for mm-hmm. the season. Went with that, and the leap out that we get here, What Price Gloria, would not actually air until Dennis, the
fourth episode
of the second season. And it's really one of the very, very few times that something like that happens. Now, in syndication... It was all over the place.
They would
change the leap outs at a whim.
Mm-hmm.
But in this instance, it was actually a case of them doing the leap out and it not end up being the leap out at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so, and that's the end of the first season.
That is the end of the first season.
And I'm curious to know, like, I don't know, like, when the last episode aired, whether they absolutely knew whether or not the show had been picked up for a second season. Or if it was still on the bubble.
That's a very, very good question. I'm not sure about that either. It's probably a piece of information that is in the wonderful book by Matt Dale, Beyond mm-hmm. the Mirror Image.
Mm-hmm. And it's also weird because, like, Played Against Seymour, like, even though it's a very genre-heavy episode, it's also a very regular episode. And every other season of Quantum Leap ends with more of a bang.
Yeah.
If not a cliffhanger, at least, it ends in a way like, you know, that either Sam or Al's lives personally have been more deeply affected.
Mm-hmm.
Than just your regular leap.
You know, it does say, actually, just reading real quick in Beyond the Mirror Image, it does say that it came as a bit of a surprise to the cast and crew that they did get the second season, but it doesn't say that it was necessarily, like, they thought they were going to be canceled. It just that they were surprised that they got it. The other interesting thing is not only did they get the second season, but the second season would actually start in September as opposed to October, which is something that wasn't normal either. So it was kind of interesting that NBC was like, you know, let's go for it.
Mm-hmm.
I clearly I don't have to thankfully, I don't have to imagine what it would have been like had this been the last episode. I will say that if all we had gotten of Quantum Leap was the
We'd be sitting here
season,
doing a Sliders podcast.
I don't even know that I would ever give the show much of a second thought. I hate to say that, because there are some really nice moments in season one, but...
I don't know, it was very, I would probably would live in the same headspace for me as the TV show Nightmare Cafe.
Yeah, I don't know that show. No.
So Nightmare Cafe, it was presented as Quantum Leap meets Twilight Zone meets Cheers.
Wow. Okay.
It starred Robert Englund
uh-huh.
of Nightmare on Elm Street fame.
Yeah.
And at the start of the first episode, two characters get killed in the process of trying to do the right thing. They get murdered.
Okay.
And they find themselves in this mysterious cafe, which is basically like a purgatory where you get to go back and right one wrong before you move on to the next thing.
Okay.
And Robert Englund, his character's name was Blackie, and basically he was the Al
okay.
of that series, where basically he guided everybody else through their thing. So these two characters, this man and woman, who die at the beginning of the first episode, they become the cook and the waitress of this cafe. And throughout the six episodes that the series lasted, they help the people who have just died. They help them right one more wrong before they move on to the next.
All right.
As I understand it, it was supposed to be a limited run series. It wasn't supposed to go on any longer than
yeah.
that. But again, it only lasted for six episodes. I don't think you can, unless you just find somebody out there on the internet who happens to have copies of it.
Yeah.
But again, it would probably live in that headspace.
Yeah. No. That's. All right. I mean.
So, Dennis, are you like the expert in all things time travel?
Not all things. I lean really heavily into them, but...
Okay.
Why do you ask?
Because you love Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
You love this show. You just
mm-hmm.
brought up that other show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
it seems
like time travel is kind of a thing with you.
Time travel is kind of a thing. They were like, Nightmare Cafe wasn't even really... it wasn't even really a time travel thing, because
yeah.
like them going back to fix one last thing wasn't necessarily literally going back in time. It was just somehow... reinserting themselves into the lives of the people who wronged them right before.
Oh, okay.
They left.
Huh.
Mm.
Yeah.
Huh. Alright.
I would say check it out, but you're not going to find it anywhere, but...
I mean, you can find anything these days.
For sure.
You dig hard enough.
Mm-hmm. If you're listening and you happen to have copies of Nightmare Cafe...
Right. I mean, I'm a fan of anything Robert Englund does, so...
Reach out, yeah.
Adventures of Ford Fairlane...
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know.
But anyway, I was going to say to wrap it up.
Yeah.
Final thoughts on the episode. I know where Sam lies on this episode.
Well, here's the thing. It's not like I hate it. It's not my least favorite of season one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really isn't. I think that it does a lot right. There is a lot to like about it, but some of it does feel very forced, and some of it feels like it couldn't decide exactly what it wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two things that just kind of turn me off in general. You know, I like things that know what it is that they're you know, the world that they in which they
mm-hmm.
are operating and existing in. And
I guess it's interesting because like in the first season they hadn't even figured out what the show was,
right?
And then to try to lay a genre episode on top of it,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to what you're saying, Sam, I could see what you're saying, but to me it didn't bother me as much.
Yeah.
Because if you think about the genre of noir in general, it is kind of, like what we were talking about at the very beginning of this podcast, that, you know, it's so easily parodied
mm-hmm.
that sometimes it feels like when you're watching this episode, it's like, okay, well, are they poking fun at it, or are they actually trying to replicate this?
Yeah.
And to me, it felt like they were trying to replicate it, but you have these outsiders who come in who are very much of a modern mindset, being like, what is this language they're using and whatnot?
Yeah.
So for me, that's kind of how I interpreted it, but I could also see where you're coming from, that like, what are they trying to do here?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's funny. All of a sudden, as you were saying that, one of the things I got reminded of, oddly enough, was the Dick Tracy movie, which I feel like is a better example of what this episode, in my opinion, and I could be wrong about this, in my opinion, of what this episode is trying to do. Because that Dick Tracy film does a wonderful job of being this sort of, like, day-glow noir film with these, you know, sort of superficial, heightened characters in these, you know, sort of comedic, almost parody-type moments, while also having a very sort of... I don't know. The world feels true to everything that they're operating in, where sometimes I just don't know. I don't know whether or not to be scared for Sam's life or to be scared that somebody's going to crack a bad joke. I guess that's how I would sum it. That's great.
But, and then, I mean, to juxtapose this with the next episode we'll cover, Honeymoon Express, like, that one you actually get the sense that someone could die.
Yeah.
This one...
And I would even argue that Honeymoon Express feels, you know, it almost gets the film noir bits more right than this episode does.
Mm-hmm.
Because this one feels very stereotypical, whereas that one, it just so, you know, it's like, it feels right that, yes, they're on this train and, you know, and there's, here's this foggy evening and, you know, whereas it's like, of course it's raining, you know, in this episode. But, I mean, that said, it is a fun episode, and Claudia Christian in particular is a great guest star. Seymour Willie Garson is a great guest star. There's, you know, there's some really nice moments, and clearly there's some imagery that'll be reused in the credits throughout the run of the series from this episode. And it's, I think the other thing is that everybody seems to be having a lot of fun, and yet when you do get some of those more serious moments, especially the stuff between Sam and Al, it works.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's not my favorite episode of the first season. It's certainly not my least favorite.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's kind of where I am.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah.
Again, it's weird that this is where they ended the season.
Yeah. Especially knowing that they had a few more episodes already in the can. Because they had like two or three more episodes already shot. They just didn't get the chance to air them.
Other than What Price Gloria?
There was at least one or two others.
I could see them going out on Disco Inferno.
Yeah.
As a season ender. Which is the second episode of the second season.
That's great.
I like the title. That's all I know about it. The title. Yeah, I mean, you know, the episode, you know, to be perfectly frank, I enjoyed it. But I didn't really understand why it has the following that it does. I mean, it seemed kind of like lighthearted fun. But then hearing you guys talk about it, clearly there's much more to this universe than these, you know, two characters and how they interact and what the show has to say about life in general. And, but I wasn't really picking up on that so much in this episode. But I did enjoy it. Yeah, it was good.
So maybe as a final question to take us out, Sam, if you were to give Annie another episode to watch to kind of counterbalance this one, to redeem it, to say no, this isn't what Quantum Leap is. This is what Quantum Leap is.
Oh man, I think I, you know, because they're fresh in my mind, I might say either Honeymoon Express, because I do think that it is, especially again in this day and age. You know, you go to a website and you go to Google and you're just like, you know, how do I get into such and such TV show? Like the Star Trek shows in particular are perfect for doing this, because they'll give you like the quick shot where it's like, instead of watching 100 episodes, you watch like 40 and you get everything you need. And if I were to fast track somebody with Quantum Leap, I might not even show them the pilot, Star-Crossed, or Color of Truth from the first season first. I would show them those episodes, perhaps, but I might just jump them right into Honeymoon Express, you know, or at the very least, I would feel them out to see, like, what is it that they would like about the show before getting into the show. Because I don't know that you need to watch it in order. You know what I mean? Like, you should see Genesis first, probably, but yeah, I guess I would say Color of Truth or Honeymoon Express.
See, if I was to fast-track someone in the series, I would say MIA... The Leap Home Part 1 and the Leap Home Part 2.
Sure.
Which is season 2 ender and then the first two episodes of the third season.
How many seasons are there?
Five. First season was only 8 episodes because it was a mid-season replacement.
Ah, okay.
And they didn't even get to air all the episodes they shot for that season. I can't figure out what the other episode is. I'm pretty sure there's one more episode, though, besides mm-hmm. What Price
They did eventually air. There's no
right,
there's no unaired
right.
episode.
There's no, like, missing... Yeah, exactly.
Out somewhere.
But, yeah, so I guess that's kind of where I am with this one, mm-hmm. you know? And yeah, I stand by Honeymoon Express. Honeymoon Express is a good way in, I feel like. Mm-hmm. You watch that episode, you get a good idea of the show.
Yeah, awesome. Well, I think that wraps up this episode. We're going to drop, I don't know if we're going to do it as its own week or a special episode. We're going to do like a season one recap episode.
Yeah.
And we're also going to talk about recently, if you're a Quantum Leap fan, you probably heard at LA Comic Con last week, there Don Bellisario and Scott Bakula were there. And Bellisario mentioned that he had written what is essentially a reboot script for Quantum Leap, which has the Quantum Leap social media, all maybe 200 of us. A buzz talking about it, so I have feelings about that.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm even going to go one step further and say that we would love to genuinely have a dialogue about this. So we're going to throw some stuff up on Facebook. We'll throw some stuff out there on, you know, on Instagram, Twitter, everything. We really want to gather some other opinions. You know, we'll read and discuss some stuff on the air. If anyone's feeling particularly bold and wants to, you know, Skype in with us and podcast along with us for that particular episode to talk about the possibility of a feature-length Quantum Leap, you know, whether it airs on Netflix or whatever the case may be, please drop us a line. I think it would be great to be able to have a dialogue about that. So we might even delay that season one recap / Quantum Leap feature-length script that Bellisario has apparently written episode into, you know, a few episodes deep into season two. We were going to just, in season one, do the recap episode and then jump right into season two, but we might not do it exactly mm-hmm. that way. So, but I think that's about it
mm-hmm.
for this episode. Play it again, Seymour. You know, go watch Casablanca if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. All right. Check
Take
out
care.
The Big Sleep. Check out Double Indemnity. You know, go watch the real film noir. There's a lot of good stuff out there. Anyway, thank you so much, listeners. We appreciate it.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you enjoyed what you've heard or have any questions or comments, don't be shy. Reach out to us online at www.quantumleappod.com or Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Fate's Wide Wheel. And remember to hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you may be listening. Until next time. Just a traveler, a poor